The events of the last months targeting activists in international solidarity movement, members of the Freedom Road Socialist Organization, and particularly people who are involved in the support for the rights of the Palestinian people, is really part of a pattern of practice and policies that the U.S. government has, and particularly the Justice Department and the FBI, has carried out for the last 50 to 60 years. So this is a continuation of repression against people on the left, socialists, people who are progressive. And the attacks usually always begin, or in many cases begin, with the infiltration of an activist group by an agent provocateur. Sometimes they're informants who are working with the police. Sometimes they're actually members of the police. And oftentimes these informants try to provoke people to get involved in what they believe is criminal activity, try to encourage criminal activity, and oftentimes are all reporting to the police continually about the work of the people who are involved. And of course, we know of cases, the Black Panther Party was infiltrated by FBI agents, the American Indian Movement was infiltrated, and there's a consistent policy of infiltrating organizations. In this case, with these people who have been targeted, there was a police agent that originally was placed in Minnesota who was involved in spying on the efforts to protest the Republican National Convention. After the convention was over, that informant, that police agent, stayed on and infiltrated the Freedom Socialist Organization. And from we know at least one informant, there could have been more, and we know that they have actually, this informant was provocateur, was trying to get people to do what she believed to be criminal activity. And despite the revelations of the Church Commission that this went on in the 60s, under the Patriot Act, this can still happen. You can infiltrate organizations even though they're not involved in criminal activity, and it's happened in this case. And then what happens oftentimes is once the informant is placed there and is providing information, the information that the informant provides to the government, to the FBI, much of it is exaggerated or not even true. They take that information and they put it in a search warrant, an affidavit for a search warrant, which they give to a judge, and they tell the judge, well, this is what this organization is doing, or this is what these people are saying. And the judge then accepts the word of the FBI based on the informant and issues a search warrant and allows the FBI to go and raid the homes of the people. And as we know, on September 23rd, many of the homes of people were raided. Hundreds of documents were taken, First Amendment documents, people's computers, their cell phones, their political documents, stuff in, protected by the First Amendment, were all taken. Thousands of documents were taken in coordinated raids. So they use the informant to infiltrate the group. Then they get the informant to provide information for an affidavit for a search warrant to justify the searches. Then, usually following the searches, or even independent of searches, they will convene a grand jury to try to force people to provide information about what they're investigating. And as Michael said, there's a long history of the grand jury being used against political activists. What's happened since the late 60s is the right to remain silent. If you're called before a grand jury, you have a Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. If the FBI comes to your door, you don't have to talk to the FBI. You have a right to remain silent. But what the courts have said is that if you're given what's called immunity, which means now that originally the immunity was transactional immunity, which means that if you testify, for example, about a bank robbery, they can never charge you with the bank robbery. The court has now limited that immunity to what's called use immunity, which means what you say in front of the grand jury cannot be used against you. Once they give you that immunity, you have to testify. That immunity takes away your Fifth Amendment right. So even though the information you say can't be used against you, they can still charge you with crimes by independent information, but more importantly, they want to turn you into an informant against your movement. So they want to ask you questions about your political associations, your political beliefs, your neighbors, where you travel. All these things are open questions before the grand jury. And of course, as Michael said, you go into the grand jury without a lawyer. A lawyer can't go in with you. There's no judge in the grand jury. It's just the prosecutor and 23 people who are basically rubber stamps of the prosecutor. It's been said that a grand jury would indict a ham sandwich if the prosecutor wanted them to. So they use the grand jury to investigate more information against political movements and to intimidate people, because if you're given immunity and you don't testify, you can go to jail for contempt. And there's two types of contempt. There's civil contempt, which is measured by the life of the grand jury, which is usually 18 months, or there's what's called criminal contempt, which can be up to life in prison. And I recently represented a Palestinian man who refused to be an informant against this movement, refused to testify in the grand jury, and he was given 11 years in prison for refusing to testify. That act of civil disobedience, he was given 11 years in prison. So once they did the raids, first they put the informant in there, then they did the raids, then they gathered all this information, then they issued these subpoenas, first 14 subpoenas for people who are active in the anti-war movement and active in solidarity work for Palestine and Colombia. And then after those 14, there was another 9 people subpoenaed to the grand jury. So 23 people were subpoenaed to the grand jury in this case. But the great thing was that people refused to voluntarily cooperate with that grand jury investigation. Every single person said they are not going to voluntarily go in there and give information to that grand jury. And that solidarity and the organizing around that resistance, which has been built up for 40 years by different movements, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement, the Black Liberation Movement, the Women's Movement, the Catholic Left Movement, have all taken a position of that kind. Many people have gone to jail, but it's a position of anti-collaboration. We will not collaborate with an arm of the FBI and the arm of the U.S. Attorney's Office who is trying to repress political movements. But because those 23 people stood in solidarity, and because people organized, they have not at this point moved to force people to testify under threat of contempt. And I believe it's because they know that these people will not cooperate, and by putting these people in jail, they're going to create martyrs and people will be able to rally around them. So the resistance to the grand jury in this case has been quite significant. It's been unified, it's been political, and it's one of the reasons why no one has been forced to testify or go to jail. So you have the informant, you have the FBI raids, you have the use of the grand jury, and then the final piece in this act of repression is the return of indictment. And usually the indictments are conspiracy indictments, which means that you don't have to prove anyone actually took any specific act. You just have to prove an agreement. There's a seditious conspiracy, which was used against the Puerto Rican Independence Movement, which basically says conspiracy to oppose the authority of the U.S. government in Puerto Rico. There's what's called a RICO conspiracy, which is a racketeering, influence, corrupt organization conspiracy, in which the government accuses a group of being a criminal enterprise and then says that the members of the group are part of a conspiracy to violate the law. And that's been used against political activists, Palestinian activists, Black liberation activists. There's a conspiracy to violate the Animal Enterprise Act that's been used, conspiracy against animal rights activists. And there's the general conspiracy law, which makes it a crime to agree to agree to only, it's an inchoate offense, agree to only commit a crime, even if no one actually takes a step to commit a crime. In this case, what we are looking at is the probability, if there are indictments, and we think there most likely will be indictments, that they're going to be brought under what's called the material conspiracy to provide material support for a foreign terrorist organization. Now, what does that mean? The Secretary of State was given the power back in 1996 to designate foreign organizations as terrorist organizations. There's no open hearing about it. There's no right to be heard in opposition to it. The Secretary of State can rely on hearsay, newspaper articles, secret testimony, and they make a list of organizations which they believe are terrorist organizations. Four of the five main Palestinian organizations are on that list. There are groups from Colombia, from Nepal, all over the world, and mostly they're groups that the U.S. They oppose U.S. foreign policy, and the U.S. is involved in supporting the governments that these organizations are involved with. The law says that if you provide material support for such an organization, that that's a crime. And material support under the language of the law can be training, can be service, can be supporting the issues and causes of that organization, can be providing money for that organization. So the law is very broad. And what happened is in June of this year, the Supreme Court interpreted that law to say that First Amendment activity, demonstrations, writing articles, explaining to people about the this organization can be criminal acts and provide material support. So for example, if you write an op-ed piece that's about an organization that's on that list, that could be considered providing material support. And what the court said was that any act which is in coordination with or under the direction of one of these organizations, you can be charged with providing material support and be in prison for up to 15 years. Now, I'm not talking about providing weapons or providing safe houses or providing anything that has anything to do with violence, and not even necessarily providing money directly to these organizations. What I'm talking about is supporting the political ideas of these organizations. If the government believes that you're doing it in coordination or under the direction of one of these organizations that's on the list, you can be charged and convicted of providing material support. And the other thing that's so insidious about this law is that the government claims that many of these organizations work through front groups, which means groups that are on the ground, non-governmental organizations, particularly in the Middle East. You have many non-governmental organizations who are doing work serving the needs of the people. Well, the government says that these groups, many of these groups, are front groups for these designated foreign terrorist organizations. So that if you are working with a group that's providing an orphanage or a hospital and has nothing directly to do with one of these groups, but the government claims that they're a front group for that organization, that can be considered material support for a terrorist group. If you're charged with this type of indictment, you cannot go into court and challenge whether the group is really, in fact, a terrorist group. Once the Secretary of State puts them on the list, they're on that list, and it's not an issue for a jury to decide. The only issue is to decide is whether you knowingly provided material support. Jimmy Carter, who went and helped Hezbollah with the elections in Lebanon and worked with them, would be providing material support for a designated terrorist organization. The Los Angeles Times, which published an op-ed article from the leader of Hamas, would be providing material support for a terrorist organization. Now, we know Jimmy Carter and the LA Times is not going to be charged under this statute. But the breadth of this statute, a lawyer filing an amicus brief challenging whether Hamas or any other group is a terrorist group could be providing material support for that group. A demonstration about in support of a group or a political prisoner of a group that's on that list. The leader of the PFLP, for example, is in prison in Israel. If you are active in supporting the freedom of that leader and you are writing articles in support of that, you could be charged with providing material support. So material support for terrorism, it's very important. It's not about bombs and guns and safe houses. It's about First Amendment activity. And in fact, the case that was decided in June in the Supreme Court was called Holder versus the Humanitarian Law Project. The reason it's called Holder is because it was brought by the Obama administration by Eric Holder, who was the Attorney General. The lower court had found that it would be a violation of the First Amendment to criminalize First Amendment activity under the material support law. The Obama administration decided to appeal that decision to the Supreme Court. The plaintiffs in that case were human rights activists who were trying to teach the Kurdish movement how to file human rights complaints at the United Nations. And they brought a case saying, can we do this? It wasn't a criminal case, it was a civil case. Can we advise them how to file human rights violations in the United Nations? Can we teach them how to negotiate peace agreements? And the Supreme Court said, if you're working with that group under their direction or under their control, whether you're just advising them how to provide human rights complaints or how to get peace agreements, you can be prosecuted under the law. So that's the situation. They brought the case to the Supreme Court, and we have, as you know, a very reactionary Supreme Court. Just today, the Supreme Court said you couldn't sue Attorney General Ashcroft for using the material support, using the material witness law. Now, they were locking people up after 9/11 saying they were material witnesses without charging them with crimes using like a law of preventive detention. And they locked up hundreds of people, not charging with crimes, saying they were potential witnesses and they were gonna flee, so they locked them up. And again, the lower court in California said that was against the law. That's using preventive detention. The material witness law was never for that. The Obama administration appealed that decision, and today the Supreme Court said, oh, that's okay, they can do that. You can't sue Ashcroft for that kind of activity. So we have a situation where people may think we have a new administration here who is changing the direction of civil liberties and civil rights. But in fact, they are institutionalizing what Bush began, because now there's no outcry from the Democrats about it. They're going along with it. So now the rendition, sending people to other countries to be tortured, preventive detaining people, using this material law, using this material support law, have all been used and approved by the Obama administration, and when they lose a case in the lower court, they bring it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court reverses the lower court. So we're now looking at a situation where we have 23 people who are under the threat of being held in contempt. Because of the support of you and other people, they have not moved on them. But I can assure you that the grand jury is hard at work. The FBI is hard at work, the U.S. attorney is working, and there will be most likely indictments under the material support for a foreign terrorist organization. And when they bring these indictments, we're going to need your support. We're going to need your support in the courtroom. We're going to need you to line up every day to come to court. We're going to need your public support condemning it in the newspapers, in the area of public opinion. We're going to need your resources to support the legal defense, and we're going to need your outrage, because what has happened here is outrageous. They are criminalizing people who are not even close to being involved in terrorist activity. Nothing they've done other than speak out, organize, demonstrate, write articles, put out a newspaper, has nothing to do with terrorism. But what they're doing is trying to silence people who are trying to educate the American people about what's going on in the Middle East and Colombia. They don't want people to know how the Palestinian people are being treated and rights are being denied. One of the people that I've been representing, Hatem Abadeya, who can't be here tonight because his mother is ill, is the executive director of the AAAN, Arab American Action Network. And he is one of the main people they've targeted. His house was raided, all his books were taken, all his personal property was taken. They also wanted documents from his organization. He's been subpoenaed to a grand jury, and he is one of the main people they're trying to silence because of his activity and the work he's done here in Chicago and throughout the United States. He and other people here need your support and need you to stand up and say no. Regardless of what the administration is going to do, we need people who are going to fight for the rights of these people. Thank you.